Welcome.
Oh, so what are we going to talk about?
Invite Drew Hansen back. Drew, state senator from Washington near the Seattle area. I got that right this time, right? Did I? Correct me.
Yes.
He is lecturing on Mark Rubin's here, and he will talk tonight about his political activism. So I'll give it to Drew.
Oh, no.
Yay! All right, thank you everyone for being here tonight. I was just groveling because I missed my appointment with the media guy to do a podcast interview, so forgive the slight delay there. It's the great thing about being at Holton, though. We're all kind of around, so it can be rescheduled. How many of you were here Monday night? Okay, how many of you is this your first time doing this one? Okay, a couple. So we'll do the super quick version of the introduction. I'm Drew Hansen in civilian life. I'm Representative Drew Hansen. I've served in the Washington State House of Representatives since 2011. I'm here this week because I wrote this book about the I Have a Dream speech, the dream Martin Luther King Jr. and the speech that inspired a nation. It is at the library and the bookstore, although you can't buy it now. You can just look at it because otherwise all faculty are like, please buy my book. And they have like 400 unsold copies, so they don't want to do that. This is going to be my second day teaching at Holden Village ever. It is not my second day at Holden Village ever. We used to come here growing up, and now we're here back for the first time for me in about 26 years with my parents, my aunt and uncle, my cousin, her husband, and one member of the family I forgot last time, my cousin's husband's mother, Kathy Pelosi. Big hand for Kathy Pelosi. So it is still taking me a little time to get into the Holden spirit. I am trying very hard. I went to yoga this morning. It is my first yoga class ever. I almost died. The thing on the kiosk said gentle yoga flow in conversation, right? So I bring my coffee because I figured we're gonna talk about yoga. What happened, right away, they're whipping us through all these poses, right? Like dog pose, cat pose, beaver pose, chipmunk pose. I mean, I don't know, all these animal poses. And they got us doing one where we're on our backs, arched up, and we're leaning up this way. And the yoga teacher is going around and says, keep your hips up. And she's adjusting all of our hips with her fingertips very gently. And when she gets to me, she still uses her fingertips. But it's the way you use your fingertips to pick up a bowling ball. And then she says in her calm yoga voice, and just be mindful of what your body is capable of. I'm trying! So we get through, we're almost done, and then we're doing pigeon. I think it's called pigeon. You put one leg over and you go up like this. And she's looking around, she says, I'm going to get some blocks to help some of you with this pose. I'm like, oh, I know who you're talking about now. She comes right over to me, and she puts a block under my hip. It's like she's jacking up a car to change the tire. My hip goes up. So I did not have much flow or much peace, and I may never go back to yoga again, but at least I tried, and that is what Holden Village is about. So yay for trying. So tonight is the second of three sessions on the life and career of Martin Luther King. Monday was the spiritual life of Dr. King. Dr. King is a preacher and a man of faith. Tonight is the civil rights career of Dr. King. So it's the part of Dr. King's trajectory that many of you will be familiar with from American history courses or your own general interest. Thursday, tomorrow, is the political implications of Dr. King's career. Monday was supposed to be nonpartisan Jesus night. I got a little bit partisan in the Q&A, but so just tonight is the civil rights trajectory, which will have some partisan implications. And then tomorrow will get hotly political. So if you're into the Jesus stuff and not the political stuff, tomorrow's not your night. But, we will not be offended. Go, eat extra helpings of curry or whatever deliciousness we have. So let's begin with a prayer before we start. Lord, thank you so much for this wonderful day at Holden. Thank you for the mountains that you made. Thank you for those repellers who are putting out that fire. Please keep them safe.
thank you that it looks like that fire is not going to spread. Thank you for that gorgeous curry we had tonight. Thank you for the new flavors of ice cream, which we're excited about. And thank you that we're all here tonight. In your name we pray. Amen. I'm sorry for these food-focused prayers. Yes, sir.
Is it okay if I record?
Yes, I think someone else is recording anyway, but by all means, like, yeah, no, thank you for asking. That's kind of you. So the Hansen family, the evening grace is each, so whoever's saying the grace before dinner has to thank God for three things. And so it's a way to get our kids who are 9 and 12 into the habit of gratitude and thanking God. And invariably it's, Lord, thank you for this delicious dinner. Thank you for the meatballs mommy made. Thank you for the sunshine. So I'm sorry, that's why I'm praying about the curry and the ice cream. That's kind of what we pray in our house. Okay, so tonight's story begins in September of 1954, when Martin Luther King Jr. is 26 years old, and he takes over the pastorate of the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. He is still, at this point, finishing up his dissertation. That might be a familiar experience to some of you in this room. It tends to take longer than you think it's going to take. That takes him the first 9 months of his pastorate into June of 1955, and then in November, Dr. King, the then newly minted Dr. King, and Coretta Scott King have their first child, a baby girl, Yolanda. At this point, King is ready to do nothing except pay attention to his parish. He's offered the presidency of the local NAACP, turns it down, because he talks about it with Coretta and decides he needs to spend time just being a parish pastor. So, and plus, it's November, he has a new baby in the house. Well, 1 month later, in December of 1955, Rosa Parks, who is not some non-political actor, but is rather actively involved in the local NAACP, refuses to stand over a row of empty seats so a white person can sit in the same row. This kicks off a long-planned boycott of the segregated buses in Montgomery, long planned for some time by the black women in Montgomery who were taking the buses to and from their jobs. The first day of the boycott, the black ministers of Montgomery convene a meeting to form an organization to support the boycott. The ministers are all men. This is, by the way, church history in a nutshell. The organizing and actual work is typically done by women, not always, but and then as soon as leadership roles come out, suddenly there's all these men who show up. So that is exactly what happens in Montgomery. So the ministers get together and they have this meeting to decide who is going to take the leadership role. The ministers pick Martin Luther King. Not an obvious choice, but he has one significant advantage. He is new in town. And the betting money was on the boycott not going particularly well. And so if it didn't go particularly well, it could be the new guy in town who gets blamed. King doesn't know why he's been chosen. But he says, well, if you think I can render some service, I will. He goes back home. He tells his wife about this new position. He goes up to his study. He closes the door. And he panics. That night is going to be the mass meeting, the first big gathering of the black citizens of Montgomery to support the boycott. And King, as the new leader of the Montgomery Improvement Association, will be the keynote speaker. King has about 20 minutes between when he goes up to his study and when he has to leave for the church. He'd given plenty of speeches before. I mean, he preached every Sunday. But he usually spent 15 hours a week preparing a Sunday sermon. This was not a Sunday sermon. This was a civil rights speech before what they hoped would be a crowd, probably with members of the media in attendance, to try to inspire people to continue. So King prays, and he asks the Lord to be with him. And he has just enough time to put down a couple words and an outline before it's time to leave for the church. His friend Ralph Abernathy picks him up, and they start driving over to the church. And on the way, they're a couple blocks away, they see cars double parked on both sides for a while. And they see cars parked up in the driveways. And they see cars parked on the lawn under the trees. King and Abernathy both have exactly the same thought. They say, did someone die? Maybe the head deacon passed away? Maybe even the preacher died. Well, they get to the church, and of course, that's not what happened at all. There are hundreds, maybe 1,000 people inside, many, many hundreds more spilling over outside the sanctuary. Now, the meetings of the civil rights movement, at least in the southern phase, and at least run by some groups, looked like church services. So that meeting starts with hymns. Onward, Christian soldiers, and what a fellowship, what a joy divine. There's a prayer, and then there's a reading from the Psalms. And then it's Dr. King's turn to speak. He starts out by describing what the conditions on the buses have been like and how unfair it is to be subjected to the kind of treatment that they were subjected to. He introduces Rosa Parks, who he calls one of the finest citizens of Montgomery, not, he says, one of the finest Negro citizens, but one of the finest citizens of all Montgomery, and how no one can doubt Ms. Parks' integrity, dedication, and commitment. And then he says, "And you know, my friends, there comes a time when people get tired of being trampled over by the iron feet of oppression." When you listen to the tape, it sounds like someone just touched a match to gasoline. The crowd explodes, yelling, cheering, clapping. You almost can't hear the next things King says. The boycott goes on. It lasts for about 13 months. It ends not because the white citizens of Montgomery realized they were wrong and Dr. King was right, but because of a federal court decision on the authority of the Brown decision, which we'll talk more about on Thursday. King's ecstatic. He says, "The Red Sea has opened for us. We are on the move. We are moving now." After this, in 1957, Dr. King doesn't win a major civil rights victory for nearly 6 years. There are other things going on in the movement. There are the Freedom Rides, sponsored by the Congress of Racial Equality, to demonstrate Southern refusal to desegregate interstate bus terminals. There are the sit-ins, which John Lewis of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was involved in, to dramatize a failure to desegregate downtown areas. King's next big campaign is in 1961, 1962 in Albany, Georgia. How many of you have heard of the legendary Albany campaign? Yeah, exactly. So that would be no one. There's a reason for this. So King comes to Albany, and the FBI, who gets very involved in the civil rights movement, not in a positive and constructive way, informs the local police chief, Laurie Pritchett, that King is coming to Albany. So Chief Pritchett reads King's book about the Montgomery bus boycott and about nonviolence. And he decides that as a strategic matter, he will do everything he can not to publicly beat or harm the Albany protesters. Now, there is plenty of violence in Albany, Georgia during this campaign. C.B. King, who's a lawyer in Albany, a black lawyer, wants to visit one of his clients who's been jailed in the protest. The sheriff takes a wooden walking stick and cracks it over C.B. King's skull. Marion King, different King, is beaten and kicked by cops in Albany until she loses consciousness. But none of this violence happens in public at a mass demonstration with hundreds of people and reporters and police cameras. So Chief Pritchett later brags that he, quote, met nonviolence with nonviolence, close quote, in Albany, which is false, but as a tactical matter, gave him what he wanted, which is the ability to keep segregation in that city in Georgia, despite the protests. The next thing King does, he realizes they need to do something bigger and more dramatic if they're going to keep the momentum of Montgomery, the sit-ins, the Freedom Rides going. And so he caucuses with his aides about where they're going to go next. And the consensus choice is probably the strongest bastion of segregation in the South, which is Birmingham, Alabama. The city became famous for its violent maintenance of segregation under the leadership of the longtime public safety commissioner, Eugene Conner, known as Bull. there have been so many black homes and churches bombed over the years that some southern black people called the city Bombingham. King's advisors thought to themselves, King said, if we can break segregation in Birmingham, we can break it anywhere in the country. So Birmingham, the police reaction is the opposite of the Albany, Georgia police reaction. Shortly after the protests begin, Bull Connor turns police dogs and fire hoses on the protesters, and the hoses are high-pressure hoses. If you're standing 30 feet away from a big oak in the south, they will take the bark right off it. Some of his cops give their dogs just enough chain so that they can lunge at the protesters and bite them without the handler losing the dog entirely. President Kennedy sees a picture of one of these dogs lunging at a protester. He says he makes him sick. National Opinion turns immediately against the segregationists in Birmingham. There is a pretty strong settlement desegregating the Birmingham downtown, and King says it is a great victory for the movement, accurately, because I don't think anyone thought that this could happen. So this touches off the summer of 1963. There are hundreds of demonstrations all around the South, about 10,000 arrests. The New York Times runs more stories about civil rights in about 2 weeks than it had done in the previous 2 years. King and the other civil rights leaders start looking for a way to continue the success of Birmingham and make it nationwide. At this point, there are plans underway for a giant civil rights demonstration in Washington, D.C., under the leadership of A. Philip Randolph, who is the 74-year-old head of the International Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, the union. Randolph had wanted to do a big march on Washington since the 1940s. He had successfully backed down President Franklin Delano Roosevelt with the threat of a march to get him to establish a commission to have more fair hiring and wartime hiring. So, but the plans for this march, I mean, they were kind of neither here nor there. They weren't going particularly quickly. A number of the leaders of the big civil rights groups said they had scheduling conflicts or were otherwise too busy. But after Birmingham, King announces that his group, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, would be in. The other civil rights groups quickly follow suit. And this becomes the plans for the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. The preparations go forward that summer under the leadership of one Bayard Rustin. Rustin was a longtime associate of King's. Back in Montgomery, King had kept, as we talked about briefly on Monday, a gun in his house because he was no fool and understood the threat of violence to his family that he was inviting by just being publicly active and visible. Bayard Rustin was the one who gently suggested to him that if he believed in nonviolence, perhaps he should not have a firearm in the home. Rustin helped him out with edits on his first book, Stride Towards Freedom, and the first time King spoke in the Lincoln Memorial, 1957, Rustin took the liberty of marking up King's speech, which did not go particularly well. King told Rustin, look, Bayard, I don't mind you criticizing my ideas, but I don't like you criticizing my words, because I'm better at words than you are. So Bayard Rustin is sort of the chief logistics officer that summer, trying to get the march underway, right? Figure out who's going to come and from where, what the speaking order is going to be, where the toilets would be, what are people going to pack? I mean, just, you know, imagine, right? It's a massive demonstration in D.C. in the era before cell phones, before email, before texting. You know, they got landlines, but that's really about it. And it's complete mania all that summer. It looks like a high-paced congressional campaign. Bayard Rustin's chief aide is spending time sleeping on a cot under his desk because he's just not going home. The only people in America paying more attention than Bayard Rustin to the plans for the march are the FBI. The FBI at this point had from some years been increasingly obsessed with the civil rights movement as a threat to American democracy, in their view. There was a strong suspicion that Dr. King was a communist and a front for a secret Soviet plot to undermine America. So when they hear about a march of as many people as could be gathered to the nation's capital, the FBI thinks this is the march to overthrow the government. And so J. Edgar Hoover instructs the special agents in charge of each FBI field office that it is their, quote, personal and continuing responsibility, close quote, to monitor what's going on with the preparation for the march. Not bank robbery, not gambling, not gambling, this, the March on Washington, you got to figure out what you're doing there. And sure enough, if you go read the reports from the field offices, it's all about, if you're in New Britain, Connecticut, you can get tickets from Sergeant Clifford Willis of the Willis Barbershop. I mean, it's that level of sort of absurd paying attentionness to the preparations for the March on Washington. The FBI, by the way, meanwhile, is tapping the phone of Dr. Kane and some of his aides. And so from time to time in these talks, I've been able to share with you exactly what Dr. Kane said in various private conversations, which we can do because we have the transcripts of the FBI phone taps. Okay, so we get to a few days before the march, and Kane finally starts to prepare his speech for the evening. He gives hundreds of speeches a year, as we talked about on Monday. Usually he doesn't have enough time to do a couple notes, an outline of the back church of a church bulletin, like we said Monday, the list of people he's got to thank, and he's done. March on Washington's different. He knows it will be a big event. And so in a conversation recorded by the FBI, he tells one of his aides he would like to say something like sort of a Gettysburg Address, he says. So he asks a couple of his advisors to put some drafts together, who we talked about a little bit on Monday. And he doesn't really, you know, he thinks a little bit about it. He thinks about using this bit about a dream that he had used many times before that summer. He used it in Albany, Georgia. He'd used it elsewhere, talking about the dream he had for America. But he doesn't get very far. He gets to Washington, D.C. He doesn't have anything remotely resembling a draft of what he'll do that day. King checks into the Willard Hotel in Washington, and he gathers all of his aides together, and they start this roundtable discussion of what's going to go into the speech. One wants him to talk about housing discrimination, another about jobs, another one, I mean, it's going to look like a State of the Union address, right? Everybody's going to get their little special thing in there. And King finally puts up his hands. He says, "My brothers, I understand. I appreciate all the suggestions. Now let me go and counsel with the Lord." So he goes up to his suite at the Willard Hotel, and he spends the entire night writing the speech out in longhand. One of his aides, Andrew Young, later Ambassador Andrew Young, comes by, and he notices how Kane has crossed out individual words three times, four times, written something else above, looking not just for the right word, but for the right rhythm. Young thinks it's almost like he's trying to write poetry. So Kane awakes the next morning. About 2 in the morning, he hands this written speech he worked all night on off to his secretary to type it up, and it gets mimeographed and distributed to the press. So that takes you to August 28, 1963, the morning of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. Kane wakes up that morning, and there's no one really there. The Kanes are listening to the radio, and the early call by the announcers is that there's 25,000 people expected, maybe. And Kane and Coretta leave to go down to the Washington Monument, disappointed by what it looks like is going to be an awfully small turnout. Byard Rustin is standing at the Washington Monument, and there are a throng of reporters around him. And they start pressing him. They say, "Mr. Rustin, you promised a march of more than 100,000. Where are all the people?" Rustin has a yellow legal pad in his hand, and he looks intently at it and says, "Gentlemen, everything is going exactly according to plan." One of his aides looks over his shoulder and sees the pad is blank. So at Union Station, though, near D.C., the buses and the trains are coming in regularly. The crowds before long get to a level that one onlooker said from D.C. that they hadn't seen since the end of World War II. Buses and trains pull in, disgorge their demonstrators, back out, making room for the next one. A train from the south. Many of the people in the South chartered special trains for this. So a Freedom Special from Florida comes up. A bunch of young people tumble off singing, "Woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom." By late morning, the lawns around the monument are packed with people. And people start opening up the box lunches that they prepared. No mayonnaise. That was actually something that's on the instructions for the march. No mayonnaise in your sandwiches. Because it's Washington, D.C. in August and it might spoil. Good advice by Byard Rustin, master of details. About 11 in the morning, People start to make their way to the Lincoln Memorial, where the formal program will begin. Well, Bayard Rustin, Dr. King, and the other civil rights leaders get out of their morning meetings with congressional leaders to find this huge throng of people just walking slowly toward the Lincoln Memorial. Bayard Rustin says, "My God, they're going! We're supposed to be leading them." He grabs them, knocks everyone apart, and the leaders grab hands and sing, "We Shall Overcome." And that's the picture on the front of my book. And what you can't see is all the marchers ahead who are already at the Lincoln Memorial before them. So there's a long afternoon of songs and speeches at the Lincoln Memorial. King had the last spot of the day, which was a subject of contention. Some people wanted that honor, right, the kind of keynote last spot of the day, to go to Roy Wilkins, the head of the NAACP, the nation's oldest civil rights organization. We'll talk more about Mr. Wilkins tomorrow.
St. Paul boy.
Is this St. Paul boy? Yeah. Perfect. King's aides say, kind of press for him to get the last spot. Bayard Rustin sensibly is like, "Look, none of you want to speak after King. Let me just be look out for your own self-interest here. None of you want to go after King." But some of the leaders think to themselves, this is going to be late in the afternoon by the time the last speech of the day happens. By then, all the TV cameras will have to leave to go process their film. And the only speeches that anyone will ever see and be featured on the evening news will be the ones earlier in the day. So that's fine. Let's let King go last. It's a long program. And of course, everyone has to have their say. Eventually, we have a speech from, we'll read a little bit of this. I think we're doing okay on time. A lot of you are interested in John Lewis. True statement?
Yeah.
Okay. So all you need to do is like tap me with your finger to talk more about John Lewis. So what we're going to do is we're going to hear a little bit about John Lewis's speech in the March on Washington. Philip Randolph, the organizer, steps to the microphone, introduces Brother John Lewis. The crowd stops fidgeting because by then, you know, you've heard heaven knows how many speeches, starts to pay attention. John Lewis doesn't even acknowledge Bayard Rustin as Bayard Rustin's trying to shake his hand and pat him on the back. He walks right up to the podium. He licks his lips a couple times. He looks out, he sees the crowd, he thinks to himself, my. He looks over here, and like we talked about on Monday, he sees a couple of his friends from SNCC clapping and yelling to encourage him. Here it is, he thinks, and he starts to speak with the thick rural accent of the Alabama farm he'd grown up in, at a pace that he would think many years later might have been too quick. "We march today for jobs and freedom, but we have nothing to be proud of, for hundreds and thousands of our brothers are not here. They're receiving starvation wages or no wages at all. While we stand here, there are sharecroppers in the Delta of Mississippi who are out in the fields, working for less than $3 a day, 12 hours a day. While we stand here, there are students in jail on trumped-up charges. Our brother James Farmer, along with many others, is also in jail. We come here today with a great sense of misgiving." And right away, it's clear to the crowd that this sounds nothing like any other speech they've heard that day. He talks about the Civil Rights Bill, President Kennedy's Civil Rights Bill. "It is true that we support the administration's Civil Rights Bill. We support it with great reservation, however. Unless Title III is put in this bill, there is nothing to protect the young children and old women who must face police dogs and fire hoses in the South while they engage in peaceful demonstrations." The crowd interrupts him at that point, the first time, with applause, and Lewis sees the crowd's reaction, and it seems like he becomes more sure of himself. He starts to speak more forcefully. "In its present form, this bill will not protect the citizens of Danville, Virginia, who must live in constant fear of a police state. It will not protect the hundreds of thousands of people who have been arrested on trumped-up charges. What about the three young men, SNCC field secretaries in Americus, Georgia, who faced the death penalty for engaging in peaceful protest? As it stands now, the voting section of this bill will not help the thousands of black people who want to vote. It will not help the citizens of Mississippi, of Alabama, and Georgia, who are qualified to vote but lack a sixth-grade education. One man, one vote is the African cry. It is ours, too. It must be ours. My friends," he says, "let us not forget that we are involved in a serious social revolution. By and large, American politics is dominated by politicians who build their careers on immoral compromises and ally themselves with open forms of political, economic, and social exploitation. There are exceptions, of course. We salute those. But what political leader can stand up and say, my party is the party of principles? For the party of Kennedy is also the party of Eastland. That's James Eastland, the longtime segregationist Democratic senator from Mississippi. The party of Javits, Jacob Javits, Republican congressman from New York, a lion champion of civil rights, is also the party of Goldwater. You know who that is. Where is our party? Where is the political party that would make it unnecessary to march on Washington? Where is the political party that would make it unnecessary to march in the streets of Birmingham? Where is the political party that will protect the citizens of Albany, Georgia? Do you know that in Albany, Georgia, 9 of our leaders have been indicted, not by Dixiecrats, but by the federal government for peaceful protest? But what did the federal government do when Albany's deputy sheriff beat attorney C.B. Kane and left him half dead? What did the federal government do when local police officials kicked and assaulted the pregnant wife of Slater Kane and she lost her baby? To those who have said, be patient and wait, we must say that we cannot be patient. We do not want our freedom gradually, but we want to be free now. We are tired. We are tired of being beaten by policemen. We are tired of seeing our people locked up in jail over and over again, and then you holler, be patient. How long can we be patient? We want our freedom, and we want it now. You talk about slow down and stop. We will not stop. All the forces of Eastland, Barnett, Wallace, and Thurman will not stop this revolution. If we do not get meaningful legislation out of this Congress, the time will come when we will not confine our marching to Washington. We will march through the South, through the streets of Jackson, Danville, Cambridge, Birmingham, but we will march with the spirit of love and dignity that we have shown here today. By the force of our demands, our determination, and our numbers, we shall splinter the segregated South into 1,000 pieces and put them together in the image of God and democracy. We must say, wake up, America, wake up, for we cannot stop, and we will not and cannot be patient. So on the speaker's platform, then, every black speaker rushes up to John Lewis to shake his hand and pat him on the back, and every white speaker just sits there. So he finishes, and there's more still. There are a couple more speeches. Before long, Roy Wilkins speaks, and it's fine. The marchers start to head home. Many of them had been there 6 days, been on journeys for 6 days, 7 nights, and it was time to head back to the buses. Then A. Philip Randolph introduces the gospel singer Mahalia Jackson. She sings two spirituals, I've Been Buked and I've Been Scorned, and How I Got Over. Kane is seated nearby, clapping his hands on his knees and calling out to her, preacher asking the choir to sing. She gets done with the first verse of I've Been Buked and I've Been Scorned, and Russin is trying to keep things on schedule. Mm-hmm. It is going not so great. So he walks up to try to pull her off, and the organ is going into the second verse, and she just rolls right in, stand by me, Lord, stand by me. Uh-huh. Rustin gives up. And you can see on the TV feed, which you can still see the whole thing at the Museum of Television and Radio in New York City. He stands right next to her and just starts singing along. He was in choir in college. She finishes. Roger Mudd, who's calling today for CBS News, says, Miss Mahalia Jackson and all the speeches in the world could not have brought the response to the hymn she just sang, Miss Mahalia Jackson. There's another speech by Rabbi Joachim Prince from the American Jewish Congress. And then it's Kane's turn to speak. King starts out, and he takes this speech that he'd worked all night on, and he starts reading it. And if you had been paying attention to what President Kennedy or members of Congress had said about civil rights, it would have sounded exactly the same. The basic argument of the first part of King's speech is that America was supposed to be, at least theoretically, an equal nation with opportunity. But you can see, obviously, that it is not. And so this is a betrayal of what should be the animating spirit from the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. Not only that, it is a betrayal of what Christians claim to believe about equality and dignity of each person in the eyes of God. Great in substance, identical to hundreds of other speeches from that era, because I've read all of them. Like, you can read any presidential speech, same argument. Any speech in Congress, same argument. Wonderful, right? Wonderful to have King deliver it. Wonderful to have it in his Baptist preacher's locution. But nothing unfamiliar about the argument itself. So King nears the end of his speech. He comes to a sentence that isn't quite right. He looks at his prepared speech. In the manuscript, he says he's supposed to go into his conclusion. It's supposed to start by saying, "Let us go back to our communities as members of the International Association for the Advancement of Creative Dissatisfaction," which is a little bit of a mouthful. And King on the spot decides that does not strike the right tone for the day. So instead he says, go back to Mississippi, go back to Alabama, go back to South Carolina. And off to one side, Mahalia Jackson, who had heard him speak many, many, many times before, says, "Tell them about the dream, Martin. Go back to South Carolina, go back to Georgia, go back to Louisiana, go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities, knowing that this situation can and will be changed." Ms. Jackson calls to him again, "Tell them about the dream, Martin." And King looks out over the crowd. And as he later says in the one interview he ever gave about why he decided to say, "I have a dream," that day, he says, quote, "All of a sudden, this thing came to me that I've used. I'd used many times before that thing about I have a dream, and I just felt I wanted to use it here." And so he says, he puts his speech down, he looks up, he doesn't look back down at his feet for the rest of the day. And he says, "And so I say to you today, my brothers and sisters, so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream." And he's off into some of the most beloved words in American history, a speech that he never intended to give, and that many of the civil rights leaders thought no one but the assembled marchers would ever remember. In many ways, it'd be great if you could stop the story, if not there, right around there. It was in 1963, King is Time Magazine's Man of the Year. In 1964, the Civil Rights Act passes. In 1965, the Selma to Montgomery March and the Voting Rights Act. We're telescoping this quite a bit, but these are the high points of the movement. They're not all good news. A month after the March on Washington, the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham is bombed, killing four young girls. In the summer of
1964. Yeah. About the part of his speech referring to his four little children, was that on the fly?
All on the fly. Yeah. One day my four little, yeah. So if you really want to nerd out on this type of question, which, you know, I'm a nerd, so I like doing that, there's a long run in my book where I take the speech that he had planned to give and put it side by side and interlineate it with the speech that he actually gave. And so by the time you get to I Have a Dream, the prepared speech is all blank. And the actual speech that he gave is the bold on the right. So the only parts of the speech anyone remembers are stuff that he made up on the spot. So if we were to end the story in about 1964, specifically 1965 with the Voting Rights Act, in many ways it ends on a high note. It's not all good. The members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee are being beaten viciously throughout the South. Three civil rights workers are assassinated in Mississippi in 1964. I mean, there's a long list. But the movement is getting the landmark legislative victories that were so significant, which we'll talk a lot more about tomorrow. 1965, though, turns out to be the end of not just the southern phase of the civil rights movement, but really this kind of this string of victories. There are riots that break out in the Watts neighborhoods of Los Angeles. King says to Bayard Rustin, "You know, Bayard, I worked awfully hard to get these people the right to eat hamburgers. Now I need to work to get them the money to buy them." King switches the focus of the civil rights movement to Chicago in the north. What time is it?
It's only
6:40.
Okay, good. I thought that was the 7:25 bell. That would be really bad. Okay, we're still doing all right. King switches his focus to the north and starts a major campaign against segregation in Chicago.
And lo and behold, we have Mr. Seth McClellan, expert in the Chicago movement. Give him a big round of applause. Yay! Can you only give us 2 minutes on Chicago?
Yeah, 2 minutes on Chicago. And I'm nowhere near the scholar that Drew is. But I talked to a ton of people who were really good friends with Dr. King and worked with him in Chicago. In Chicago, it's really fascinating. And I'm from Chicago, and I made a documentary that you can watch on Amazon. It's played on TV and stuff. Chicago's really interesting because if you look at Selma, just what you were saying, if you look at Selma, those victories, they were victories. They were huge, solid victories, and they came after, 50, 60 years of struggling. And part of our problem with the mythology of King is we think of it that, like, King just kind of, like, magically did this because he was so awesome, right? But he was really at the end of this much longer movement. And then Chicago was all these, these brilliant strategists and these brilliant people saying, let's shift our movement towards the North and to the problems of the urban North and to the problems of poverty, which is a super complicated thing. So they came to Chicago and it wasn't that kind of glorious victory. It was incredibly complicated. There was the Democrats were in charge. Daley was in charge. I think you were familiar with Mayor Daley. And Mayor Daley was, in a lot of ways that activists have problems now, is Mayor Daley was in some ways very supportive of them. He didn't provide that clear counterpoint that you have in the South, right? Where it was like, the dogs and the police and people being incredibly oppositional, which allows you to create this really clear narrative. Instead, Daley, in some ways, was very supportive, and he thought of, African Americans as just another political group. That vote for me was his attitude, right? And not addressing the underlying systematic problems. And so Carson Claiborne, who you probably have corresponded with a fair amount, talks about Chicago as a new battle. And that Chicago's the battle that we're still trying to figure out, which is how do you deal with massive problems of urban poverty? And that this is a new thing. And I think so many of our problems, we think that it's just greed and prejudice, but really it's just that it's really new for us to deal with millions of people and huge different groups. And coming into Chicago, King was embraced by the Chicago Freedom Movement and they invited him in, but Black people were booing him when he was out on the street. And that had never happened in the South. And ministers would say, we don't want you here, because they have their own power structure. And so it was a wildly different thing. And one of my interviewers, some great quotes from my interview subjects, was in the South, the police beat you up. In Chicago, the people beat you up. Because the police weren't interested in fighting with them, they were protecting them, but they were dealing now, instead of with Selma, instead of with the small, tight-knit community, they were dealing with huge white immigrant, ethnic white immigrant groups who had their neighborhoods, who had their enclaves, and those were much more of their opposition rather than this clear government figure.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you for knowing so much. Okay, round of applause for Seth McClellan. Go see us later on tonight. So, we are about done, because this is where things start to kind of unravel. King says, to Professor McClellan's point, I've never seen anything like it about the crowds in Chicago. I've never seen, even in Mississippi and Alabama, mobs as hostile and hate-filled as I've seen in Chicago. Mm-hmm. There's a pretty weak settlement about residential segregation, and there's this new note of resignation that you hear in King's speeches at about this time. He says, let's face the fact, most of us are going to be living in the ghetto 5-10 years from now. Morally, we ought to have what we say in the slogan, freedom now. But it all doesn't come now. That's a sad fact of life you have to live with. In his speeches at around this time, in his private conversations, he talks about how he's tired. He says, I've been in this thing. That's actually what comes out on the wiretaps. The thing he talks about the most is how hard it is to get in and out of airports, particularly Baltimore. He hated getting out of the Baltimore airport. He is sick all the time because he's on the road all the time, and he's exhausted. And he just talks about how tired he is. And one of his aides says, it's as if there's this weary and wounded spirit that it takes over him. So it's at this point that he starts planning for the Poor People's Campaign, which we'll talk more about tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And it's on a recruiting tour for the Poor People's Campaign, which is meant to be, as we talked about briefly on Monday, this multiracial effort against poverty.
that takes him to Memphis in April of 1968. So three quick things, and I'm sorry, this is, I've spoken way longer than I thought of. That was the John Lewis speech, so sorry about that. It's my, I thought it was good, I like it a lot. So three things kind of just to leave you with reflections for tonight. First is the role of violence in the civil rights movement. Segregation's a violent system, right? And there's obvious violence, like Birmingham. And then there's less obvious, but still real violence. So a story King tells a lot in his sermons is about how when his daughter Yolanda was three and she hears a commercial on the radio for an amusement park called Funtown. And she asks, let's go to Funtown. And as King says, he has to tell her, we can't go to Funtown because, quote, we are colored. And colored people are not allowed into Funtown, close quote. And as he puts it, I can see that little cloud of inferiority building in the sky of her mind. And that's a form of violence too, right? So, but as long as violence of segregation is invisible, it's a lot easier for people to ignore who are not directly affected by that system. When violence becomes invisible, like in Albany, nothing happens. When it is visible, as in Birmingham, things happen. And I think this might be sort of a generally true principle, right, is that every system of injustice has violence embedded in it. And as long as that violence is invisible, it is awfully hard to change. And our success at changing these systems of injustice may depend in some part on our ability to make that violence visible to people. Mm-hmm. Second one, the role of failure.
What did you just
say? Failure, the role of failure. So I think that the sort of telescope version of this history lets us skip over many years, but if you're counting the years, you think, Montgomery, 1957. Nothing until 1963. Well, that's a long period of time. Selma in 1965, nothing in 66, nothing in 67, nothing in 68. And I think it's easy for people involved in activism and political transformation work to get discouraged for multi-year stretches when nothing really seems to be happening. But that is exactly what Dr. King went through too. Third and last, and related to the second one, King's faith in the eventual transforming power of God. So we talked a lot about that on Monday, that King definitely did not think we would all grow up and learn to love each other just because, but that God would have to deliver America. So this is where we'll end tonight, is on Christmas Eve in 1967. He's preaching the Christmas Eve service at his home church, Ebenezer. And he says, in 1963, on a sweltering August afternoon, we stood in Washington, D.C., and talked to the nation about many things. Toward the end of that afternoon, I tried to talk to the nation about a dream that I had had. And I must confess to you today that not long after talking about that dream, I started seeing it turn into a nightmare. I remember the first time I saw that dream turn into a nightmare, just a few weeks after I had talked about it. It was when four beautiful, unoffending, innocent Negro girls were murdered in a church in Birmingham, Alabama. I watched that dream turn into a nightmare as I moved through the ghettos of the nation and saw my black brothers and sisters perishing on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. That's, by the way, nearly an exact quote from the original I Have a Dream speech. And saw the nation doing nothing to grapple with the Negro's problem of poverty. I saw that dream turn into a nightmare as I watched my black brothers and sisters in the midst of anger and understandable outrage, in the midst of their hurt, in the midst of their disappointment, turned to misguided riots to try to solve that problem. I saw that dream turn into a nightmare as I watched the war in Vietnam escalating, and as I saw so-called military advisors, 16,000 strong, turn into fighting soldiers. Until today, over 500,000 American boys are fighting on Asian soil. But King couldn't bear to end the sermon. I mean, his faith had never been based on concrete, tangible victories in the movement, but in the transforming power of God. And so he says, yes, I am personally the victim of deferred dreams, of blasted hopes, but in spite of that, I close today by saying I still have a dream because, you know, you can't give up in life. If you lose hope, sometimes you lose that vitality that keeps life moving. You lose that courage to be, that quality that helps you go on in spite of all. And so today, I still have a dream. I have a dream that one day men will rise up and come to see that they are made to live together as brothers. I still have a dream this morning that one day, every Negro in this country, every colored person in the world, will be judged on the basis of the content of his character rather than the color of his skin. And every man will respect the dignity and worth of human personality. I still have a dream that one day the idle industries of Appalachia will be revitalized and the empty stomachs of Mississippi will be filled. And brotherhood will be more than a few words at the end of a prayer, but rather the first order of business on every legislative agenda. I still have a dream today that one day justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I still have a dream today that in all of our state houses and city halls, men will be elected to go there who will do justly and love mercy and walk humbly with their God. I still have a dream today that one day war will come to an end, that men will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks, that nations will no longer rise up against nations, neither will they study war anymore. I still have a dream today that one day the lamb and the lion will lie down together, and every man will sit under his own vine and fig tree, and none shall be afraid. And this is the last line. I still have a dream today that one day every valley shall be exalted, and every mountain and hill will be made low. The rough places will be made smooth, and the crooked places straight. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. Now, if you're listening closely, you caught in there the reference to the Poor People's Campaign. The idle industries of Appalachia will be revitalized, and the empty bellies of Mississippi will be filled. But that is, yes, sir.
You just, a little while ago, mentioned the gaps in time when nothing big was happening in the movement. What was Dr. King doing during those periods of time?
Trying to organize other campaigns. Yeah, the same campaign or others, or writing books. So that's what he does mostly after Montgomery's. He works on his book.
And was he still actively preaching in his church during that period?
Yeah, well, good point. You're right. Actually, with his real day job, which is being a preacher. Yes, yes, exactly. Yes, sir.
What was his relationship with Kennedy? I mean, how did the surveillance happen? Wasn't Hoover answering the body during those days?
Yeah, and I think I am not totally expert in the Kennedy-Hoover dimensions. I believe Hoover had some dirt on Kennedy, too, and so he was allowed to kind of run his own shop. King's relationship to Kennedy, and we'll talk a bunch about this tomorrow, Kennedy was not originally a big civil rights president. Kennedy gets wrenched into being a civil rights champion. The Kennedy Justice Department was significant in helping with voting rights and desegregation across the South. But yeah, no, we'll do that. We'll do a big dive on that on Thursday. So let me end there. I mean, the thing I think to leave from that version of the I Have a Dream speech is, other than that reference to the Poor People's Campaign, the rest of the dream is all about the new kingdom that God will one day bring about in God's final redemption of the world. And, you know, he sounds awfully resigned, right? I still have a dream because, you know, I can't give up in life.
Yeah.
But he's still holding to that hope that God is one day going to redeem America, even though, as we talked about on Monday, he realizes that though he's looked over and seen the promised land, they may not get there with him. Anyway, okay, let's have a quick prayer, and then we have 6 minutes. Well, we have as much time as y'all want. Like, I'm sorry I fled last time. I didn't quite know what we were supposed to do at the end of these, so I just kind of left, but now we'll hang out for a little bit. Lord, thank you so much for this night. Thank you that we have another lovely day at Holden. Please bless everyone who is here tonight. Help us to know you better, understand you more, worship you more fully in Vespers this evening. And Lord, help us to hold on to this faith that you will one day bring all things under you and renew your entire creation. In your name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
All right. Does anyone have anything that's deeply on their mind that has not been covered yet? I'm sorry I spoke so long, y'all. I'm sorry. Tomorrow's going to be much shorter, so fear not. That's our theme for the summer. Fear not. Hanson will talk less. Go ahead.
It's just the repetition of I Have a Dream today, that he did that in the first speech and did even more in the sermon that you just read. And I think that's a powerful, especially after Wright's speech. He said we can't wait any longer, and I know King has said a similar thing. You know, we want to demand this today. That's very powerful for me when I've listened to King's 63 speech. And he starts out by saying, I have a dream. And then he says, I have a dream today.
Yeah.
And I think he's saying it's important to keep the power going, even though I understand that he was worn out and things. He still knew, he's not talking about, I have a dream that God someday after we all die is going to do something.
No, that's exactly right.
We're still working on the, let's get on with it today.
Yeah, no question. And that, you know, it doesn't relieve you of your obligation to take concrete action, that you trust in God's ultimate victory. No, that's a great point.
Yeah.
Anything else? Anything else on, yes, sir?
I think part of the problem of him motivating people is the fact that there was divisions in the black community, that some wanted incremental progress and some wanted progress right now. So yeah. That the two sides are warring. There wasn't a unity in that.
Oh, the black Muslims,
I think
yeah.
Philip Randall, head of the train quarters,
was
one of them, I think.
Yeah, so great. We are wonderful preview again for tomorrow, where the most significant way that you see this tension is between the NAACP, who fundamentally believes in the courts and impact litigation as a way of bringing about social change, and the entire mass protest side of the movement, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SNCC, and the rest. But yes, no, there's absolutely, and then those divisions become reflected in another way after 1965 with the rise of black power. So, no, great, great observation.
And also, I think you have to include Malcolm X in this discussion to fully understand what was going on at the time, particularly the divisions in the black community.
Yeah, so Malcolm X, not a big fan of the March on Washington, speaks very sharply against it after the Baptist Church in Birmingham is bombed and four young black girls are killed. He says, this proves that the March on Washington did nothing. There was a real carnival-type atmosphere in D.C. Everyone had a lot of fun and went home. And what did it accomplish? It accomplished nothing. Now we have four girls murdered. What did that do? And this will be a major theme of tomorrow, is exactly what does a demonstration like that, or like other mass marches more recently, actually accomplish?
Yeah, it does, yeah. Doesn't it?
Go ahead.
So were there people like Andrew Young and Jesse Jackson that came out of this movement? Did they carry on the work in some fashion on their own?
Yeah. This is great. It's like all of you are prompts for me to say, come back tomorrow. So Andrew Young, as you may know, is, of course, Ambassador Andrew Young. Jesse Jackson runs his Operation Push. John Lewis is, of course, Representative John Lewis. And they, you know, people engage in different ways. But there is a strain of the movement that goes where some of the actors in the movement go into direct representative elected office, right? Andrew Young becomes mayor of Atlanta, then John Lewis becomes congressman, others in D.C. and elsewhere. And then some of them go and take the kind of activist track, and Jesse Jackson would be maybe the most well-known example of that. And some of them are still preachers. So Walter Fauntroy, who's active in Washington, D.C., he still has his church, or at least he did not too long ago. Well, not too long ago, 15 years ago when I interviewed him, longer than that, 18 years ago when I interviewed him. Wyatt T. Walker, one of King's close associates, minister in Harlem. So those are kind of, I think, the three ways that people's careers generally flip. Yes, sir?
And hasn't there been a fair amount of controversy? I think that still exists today. I know it was after King's death that there were people who came forward claiming to have roles with Dr. King, claiming to have been one of his disciples, as John Lewis clearly was, but these were black men who they weren't really as close to King as they said that they were. One of those people I have heard is Jesse Jackson was not actually one of King's disciples.
Yeah, there's a finite circle of his very closest aides, right? Stanley Levison, Bayard Rustin, a couple others. But I think the way the dynamic, the way you're talking about comes out the most is with the key moments in King's career, like Billy Kiles, who we talked about on Monday, the preacher from Memphis whose house King was going to be at.
the night he died, says that, you know, talks about how everybody claims they were on the balcony when Kennedy's assassinated. And so if you're, how many of y'all from Wisconsin? Anyone from Wisconsin? Okay, yeah, well, there's four people. So our family's from Wisconsin. So those of you from Wisconsin know the Ice Bowl. And the, like, it is said, and it is correct, that if everyone, every Packers fan who was actually at the Ice Bowl, who claims they were at the Ice Bowl, was at the Ice Bowl, I mean, it would have been, you know, it would have been 400,000 people. So it's that kind of dynamic around it. So why don't we, I'll tell you what, it's seven, let's do one more. If anyone has a burning question, I'll just hang out here and we'll let you all get ready for Vespers. Burning question.
It's really dirty. It's not burning. But are you familiar with when King came to Seattle? And I wish I knew the year, but he came to our church, and he came to Garfield High, and a member of our church, Plymouth Church, was a teacher there. And he got basically heckled by the students. They wadded up paper to it, because he was telling them something about, if you were a street sweeper, be the best street sweeper that, has ever been seen, or some kind of thing that just didn't strike the kids. Huh. And they just...
So I didn't know about the heckling. I did know about his trip to Seattle. He treated the Northwest. He didn't spend a lot of time there. I think that was his only trip to Seattle. I think it was a fundraising trip, too. He, one of the pastors took him to the barbecue place at 19th and Yesler, maybe? Anyway, he told me about one of them. But, yeah, it was a short, kind of a short in-and-out visit. I would love, I mean, honestly, if somewhere there was the transcript or the even better, the audio of King at Garfield, boy, that would be neat. So, in any event, our amateur archivist can track that down. Okay, it is 7 o'clock. Thank you very much. Lovely to see you all. We'll see you all tomorrow. Go have fun.